This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
Welcome to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives is away, but I'm Tracy McRae, and I'm very happy to welcome back Dennis Doda from the Mayo News Network. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Tracy. You bring in the most amazing, knowledgeable, and helpful guests, that it's a treat to be back, and I always look forward to this.
I'm happy to have you here. I would contend that it's fair to say many people, not everyone, I don't know about you, but many people don't know exactly where the pancreas is located or what exactly it does. I know it's somewhere in the middle, somewhere around in the middle.
We know it's a very, very important thing, but it's one of those things that's kind of hidden away, and it's essentially important. So we'll learn a lot about that today.
That's right. One thing people, most people know anyway, is that when someone is diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, it is tough news to take. It often has a very poor prognosis, and that's even when it's diagnosed early.
Right.
Pancreatic cancer typically spreads rapidly and is seldom detected in its early stages, which is a major reason why it is a leading cause of cancer death. Signs and symptoms may not appear until pancreatic cancer is advanced, and then complete surgical removal isn't even possible.
But it is not without hope, and there are some things that can improve a patient's outlook depending on the time it's found and the approach they take to address what might be done to seek a cure. So today we're going to learn a lot more about the pancreas and pancreatic cancer from two Mayo Clinic experts, surgeon Dr. K. Marie Reed Lombardo and epidemiologist Dr. Gloria Peterson, who's doing some special research work in the area of genetics, are here to tell us about symptoms, diagnoses, and all the latest advances in treatment for pancreatic cancer.
Yeah, well, it is Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month, so it's perfect.
Right.
Perfect timing. Well, that'll be coming up next, but first we have to talk about gluten, the bad guy. You know, you should go dun-dun-dun.
Dun-dun-dun.
Yeah. There are so many gluten-free products on the shelves these days, you might think it's a near poison that you need to keep away from your family, but is gluten bad for everyone? Well, we're going to find out a little bit more from the man who literally wrote the book on going gluten-free, because that's the title of his book, Dr. Joseph Murray. Greetings. Good morning.
Good morning, Tracy.
You are the guy who wrote the book on going gluten-free now.
Well, I'm one of the much larger Mayo team who put this book together.
That is true. Is gluten bad for everyone?
Oh, most certainly not. Certainly, there's lots of people with celiac disease, much more than we would have thought even 10 years ago. And beyond that, there are several other gluten or wheat-related disorders that have kind of gotten a lot more notice in the last, I suppose, 3 or 4 years.
For people who have a gluten-related disorder like celiac sprue disease, it really is a bad thing in their system. Tell us what's taking place for people who have genuine needs to avoid gluten.
Well, what's happening within them is there's almost a battle going on between their immune system and gluten. And in celiac disease, that causes damage in the intestine. And people with allergies or with other intolerances can cause, you know, belly aches and bloating, gaseousness, diarrhea, headache, fatigue. Those types of often fairly substantial symptoms. What's going on in the world, of course, is there's lots of information out there about celiac disease, about gluten and gluten-free. A lot of that's gluten hype, though, and with our book, we're hoping to be able to cut right through that hype and provide people a comprehensive but yet readable guide that tells them all about celiac disease, about gluten, what it is, what it does. It also goes beyond that to describe these other gluten and wheat-related disorders. And finally, we like to think that this could be a survival guide for people who really need to avoid gluten, and that provides them the latest information about what is or what is not gluten-free, how to approach making themselves and their home and their environment as gluten-free as it needs to be for them. And also for people contemplating, oh, should I be going gluten-free? Should I worry about this? This provides them, I think, a very balanced, science-based answers to help them make decisions.
I would imagine that you would agree that the proliferation of gluten-free products make it a double-edged sword, because it's, as you have said in the past when you've been here, the manufacturers are slapping gluten-free on as many products as they can. And that's one of the things that makes people think that, well, I should kick gluten out of my diet entirely.
Yes, unfortunately, a lot of that is not based on science. And just because it says gluten-free doesn't mean it's healthy for everybody. It certainly is necessary for people with celiac disease, but there are lots of gluten-free products out there that are quite unhealthy given the amount of fat, salt, or sugar that have been added to make up for the taste loss if that has occurred.
Sort of what you're describing for us is that people have different sensitivities, if that's the right word, to gluten. What percentage of us really would think we could be affected by gluten in a negative way?
Well, we know about 1% of people have celiac disease. Now, that doesn't sound very much, but when you think about lifelong disease, it's becoming much more, you know, people know people with celiac disease now. Beyond that, the other conditions, the non-celiac gluten or wheat sensitivities, they're probably a bit more common, but we don't have precise numbers for how many there are. It's not 30% of the population. It's certainly not all of the population, but it's probably in the 1 out of 20, I would say, are people who may well benefit from avoiding gluten. Many of us would benefit from altering our diet and being much more aware of what we're putting in our bodies in terms of healthy options. So some people choose gluten-free, not because they feel bad, but because they think it might help them. And some people feel better. And that might be not just because they're avoiding gluten, but because they're really getting into what's healthy for me to eat, paying more attention, not eating so much fast food or junk food, for example.
Making a better choice.
Indeed.
In the past, you have said one of the hazards of this, of people self-diagnosing, is that by the time they really do come in for to have their celiac tested to see if they are, if they do have celiac disease, they have already started kind of messing with the science behind it. Explain a little bit more about that.
Well,
and I thought, you know, when this book came out, I thought, uh-oh, this is going to maybe make more people choose to go gluten-free and then mess up some testing in the future.
We hope that we've made it very clear. If somebody has symptoms that could be celiac disease, the first thing they do is talk to their doctor about getting tested. Simple blood tests can help detect that condition, so long as you haven't removed gluten from your diet first. Once somebody goes gluten-free, those blood tests become unreliable. So, excellent point. We need to be tested before going on the diet, and the right tests need to be done. They're not allergy tests. These are tests specifically for celiac disease.
And when you take that next leap then and decide that somebody really needs to avoid gluten in their diet, they have to be quite vigilant about this, don't they? It's not enough just to say, I'll avoid this food that is consisting largely of gluten. It's finding manufacturers and suppliers of foods that aren't tainted with any kind of gluten.
It really is. For people with celiac disease, they really have to avoid gluten. I think with the new labeling law that just came into effect this year, if a manufacturer puts gluten-free on a label, they have to abide by the law and make sure that there is not any significant gluten in it. It's very different when you go to restaurants. In restaurants, they may say gluten-free this or gluten-free that. That does not necessarily mean that they really are paying attention to the details of cross-contact or contamination with the kitchen, which is a big issue for people with celiac disease. It might not matter so much for people who are making a lifestyle choice of avoiding gluten, but it does for celiac patients.
The book, again, is called Mayo Clinic Going Gluten-Free, and what do you hope that this will be for people who have gluten sensitivities or celiac disease?
I hope that it will be the comprehensive guide. It'll be their source or resource for solidly scientifically based information to help them make decisions, help those who have to be gluten-free to live well and happily and healthily gluten-free. It's built also on not only on the expertise of all of us who work on celiac disease, but also real patients and their first-person stories of how they've dealt with being diagnosed or being treated on a gluten-free and how they live their lives. And I think that gives great credibility and also helps people access this. We wrote this book as an accessible guide, not as a scientific book. It's an accessible guide for anybody who has an interest in the topic.
And you can get a copy of this book at mayoclinic.org, or you can call us now. I have one copy that I guess I'm going to begrudgingly give up. It's very interesting. I started reading it last night. If you call now, 507-282-1234, our producer Audrey will take down your address and send this copy of Going Gluten-Free, The Essential Guide to Managing Celiac Disease and Related Conditions. Dr. Joseph Murray, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
All right. It's time for a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about pancreatic cancer with Dr. K. Marie Reed Lombardo and Dr. Gloria Peterson. Plus, myth or matter of fact, there is a pancreatic cancer screening test available. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up.
And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we will take your questions for our experts at 507-282-1234. You can also tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We're back right after this.
Welcome back. This is Mayo Clinic Radio, and we're talking about pancreatic cancer. It's Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. We have two guests with us today, Dr. K. Marie Reed Lombardo and Dr. Gloria Peterson. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning.
Happy to have you here for Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. I don't know if there's cards or a cake or anything, but I know that you're really excited about it, Dr. Reed Lombardo.
Yes, and I don't have my purple on like Dr. Peterson. Purple is the color for Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the pancreas. Where is it and what does it do?
So the pancreas is a very important organ. It sits really in the center of the body all the way to the back near the spine. And the pancreas is very important for insulin management, mm-hmm. for diet, for glucose management, and for giving you enzymes that helps to digest the foods in your meal, the fats in your meal.
When it comes to pancreatic cancer, where does that cancer rank among the other major cancers? And what is it about pancreatic cancer that's so frightening to people?
Well, to answer your question, it ranks 9 and 10 with males and females, respectively. And however, in terms of annual death rates, it's number 4 behind breast, wow. colon cancer, and prostate cancer. So it has a high rate of lethality. This is why it's so frightening.
But I think this is what's one of the things that's so interesting about cancer. Breast cancer, you could say, used to be so frightening towards women. Now I think there's a bit more empowerment, and maybe it's not quite as frightening as it used to be. But pancreatic cancer is one of those ones that just scares the pants off of people, because it seems like it's just one of those ones you cannot survive.
It's one of the ones that's hard to survive, but it's also one of the ones most people don't know about. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of information about breast cancer and colon cancer, and this is why we have a month like this, so people can become more educated about what pancreas cancer is, how it presents, and what are the treatment options.
Dr. Gloria Peterson, you're an epidemiologist, which is really a science in itself of understanding and interpreting statistics about different types of diseases. Tell us some of the basic things that we should be aware of when it comes to pancreatic cancer.
Yes, what epidemiologists are most interested in studying about a disease is what causes it. And they do that by comparing people who typically have the condition versus people who don't. In the case of pancreatic cancer, we've been trying to study what we call risk factors, what puts someone at increased risk. We study lifestyle factors, we study genetic factors, we study blood factors and so forth, and there's a range. We know that there are some factors that actually can even be protective. Some of the research at Mayo Clinic has shown that if the aspirin a day that people take for heart disease, for example, can be protective. Hmm. When you compare people with cancer to people, pancreatic cancer to people who don't have pancreatic cancer. And then we also know that certain fruits and vegetables in your, not certain, just eating fruits and vegetables in your diet is protective as well. Risk factors include smoking, for sure. It's actually, pancreatic cancer is considered a tobacco-related cancer.
Really?
And family history.
Isn't that something?
A few numbers. How many cases are reported each year, and what's the annual mortality from this, and what's the survival chance?
So in terms of 2014 data, a little over 46,000 people will be diagnosed this year alone, and about 30,000 will die from the disease this year alone. And in terms of all comers with pancreas cancer, whether they can have surgery or not, the 5-year survival rate is anywhere between 4% and 5%.
Wow.
So only 4 of 100 people will survive this at 5 years.
But that's part of the situation with Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month, is that maybe over the years you can nudge that up and continue to nudge that up, as breast cancer has done with earlier detection. But that's kind of the bugaboo with pancreatic cancer, is that you don't really show any symptoms until it's progressed quite a bit. So let's go back to, what are some of those symptoms that people first show, and how long maybe has someone had the cancer before those symptoms show up? Dr. Reed Lombardo?
Great. That's a great question. And so many patients will have a symptom of back or upper mid abdominal pain, just a deep achy pain that won't go away. A lot of patients will have weight loss, which is also an indication for having a cancer that is undiagnosed. The critical symptom comes when the cancer grows enough to block the main bile duct that runs into the head of the pancreas, and that creates jaundice or yellowing of the skin, and that's when most people are alerted that, uh-oh, something is going wrong.
Mm-hmm. How long does that take, I've got a dull pain that doesn't go away, to all of a sudden you're jaundiced?
Sometimes just a few months and sometimes just a few weeks.
Really?
So it's not a very long period. Dr. Peterson might want to comment also on the association with diabetes and pancreas cancer.
There are two patterns of the relationship between diabetes and pancreatic cancer. People with long-standing type 2 diabetes, 20 or more years, are at a 2 times increased risk of developing pancreatic cancer. But there's actually another way to look at it from the opposite end, and that is where the pancreatic cancer itself causes the diabetes. And this is usually occurs in people who are in their 50s and 60s, years of age, who suddenly out of the blue develop diabetes. And in a very tiny fraction of those people, the tumor is actually causing the diabetes. So it's cause and effect is reversed both ways in diabetes.
I've never heard the link between diabetes and pancreatic cancer. So Dr. Peterson, you're saying that potentially some folks who are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes are developing it because of the pancreatic cancer.
That is correct. That's actually known as pancreatic cancer-induced diabetes. It's actually type 3 diabetes, and there's a big research focus on it right now.
Are people being tested then? If you are diagnosed when you're 50 with type 2 diabetes, are people tested right away to see, is there some pancreatic cancer possibility here?
No, and the reason why is because only a very tiny fraction of people who suddenly develop diabetes in their 50s and 60s actually have pancreatic cancer that caused it. The vast majority of people still have the type 2 diabetes.
Dr. Peterson, it sounds like one of the major areas of hope in earlier detection is trying to be a detective and put together all the pieces that may be related to our genetics. Could you tell us about the biobank that you're participating in here at Mayo Clinic and how there may be clues that would finally make this not such a devastating cancer with such a terrible prognosis?
Yes, at Mayo Clinic, which is a major research center, we invite patients who have pancreatic cancer into a pancreatic biobank or research registry, and we collect as much data as we can to understand the causes and also to understand the genetics. We ask about family history, what they ate. We ask about their medical history, and then we put all that information into a database and link it to the blood sample or tissue sample that they may contribute for research. And then we try to connect the dots, as we say, and try to find the patterns. In those who have a positive family history, there is an increased risk of developing pancreatic cancer. If you have a family history, it's around 2 to 3-fold increased risk for relatives of a patient with pancreatic cancer of themselves developing it. And we've actually been trying to understand the genes that might be responsible.
That's what I was going to ask you next. A myth or matter of fact, there is a pancreatic cancer gene. Dr. Peterson?
No, that is a myth in a way, because there are genetic susceptibilities. We've actually identified a gene or more for it. It's a myth in the sense that there's only one single gene that explains pancreatic cancer. In fact, different families may have a different gene that explains the pattern of pancreatic cancer over the generations in that family.
Are there some other types of cancer that you found statistically may also predispose someone to also developing pancreatic cancer?
Yes. In terms of genetics, there are some genes, such as the breast cancer genes, BRCA1 and BRCA2, that confer an increased risk of developing pancreatic cancer. And so genetic testing in these families can actually offer some early notice that there might be an increased risk and that more vigilance should be paid to some kind of evaluation of the pancreas if one develops diabetes, for example. The same is true for another gene that is responsible for familial melanoma. Hmm. And a lot of people have not made that connection that melanoma and pancreatic cancer can run in the same family and is due to a specific gene.
That myth or matter of fact that I mentioned leads me to the one that we've been talking about this week on our Facebook page and our webpage. Pancreatic cancer screening is available. Dr. Reed Lombardo, is that a myth or is that a fact?
It's neither. Well, pancreas cancer can screening can occur with imaging studies like a CT scan or an MRI or an endoscopic ultrasound where the gastroenterologist goes down with a scope that has an ultrasound at the tip and survey the pancreas. The problem lies in the fact that patients who may be at an increased risk may have other abnormalities to the pancreas. So trying to find that mass that may be a pancreas cancer is very hard. So right now there are no formal screening methods, but those tools are used and frequent follow-up with your physician if symptoms change.
You said other pancreas issues, and we only have about 30 seconds here, but what is pancreatitis? What does that do?
Pancreatitis is inflammation of the pancreas, usually caused by excess alcohol use or gallstones blocking the pancreas duct. And pancreatitis, long-standing pancreatitis, is also a risk for developing pancreas cancer.
But not if it just pops up unexpectedly. Maybe you just want to, that's something you'd want to watch for.
You'd want to watch for it.
Very
good. If it's a long-standing process.
Got you. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest, well, we're talking about pancreatic cancer because it's Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. And our guests are Dr. Kay-Marie Reed-Lombardo and Dr. Gloria Peterson. Coming up, this week's health and medical news with Vivian Williams. Plus, we'll take your phone calls at 507-282-1234, or you can tweet us with your questions at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Reed Lombardo's been tweeting like crazy since she got here. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
That is multitasking.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Do certain blood pressure medications increase a woman's risk of breast cancer? Well, that's been a concern, but researchers at the Intermountain Medical Center Heart Institute in Utah found no, they do not. They looked at more than 3,700 records of women with no history of breast cancer and who used calcium channel blockers to control blood pressure. They found only a minimal risk increase in one study and a 50% reduced risk in a second. So they recommend women continue to use these medications to help prevent heart attack and stroke. Now on to news about people born with heart defects. An experimental three-dimensional printed model of the heart may help surgeons treat these patients. That's according to research presented at the American Heart Association Scientific Sessions. Now, most surgeons look at two-dimensional images from x-rays or MRIs when they prep for surgery, but those pictures don't tell the whole complex story. By using 2D technology as a guide, doctors can build a 3D model of the heart to show where complicated defects are. They say it helps them make better decisions before they go into surgery. And this research was done at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. And from Mayo Clinic, a diagnostic test that looks at how your chromosomes are arranged can figure out whether two separate lung cancers in the same patient are independent tumors or a tumor that has spread to another part of the lung. For patients with multiple tumors, that distinction could mean the difference between early stage cancer that may be cured by surgery and incurable late stage disease. Here's Dr. Dennis Weigel.
So this study is important for the main reason that up until the publication of these results, if someone had two different lesions in different parts of the body or even two different lesions in the lung, we were unable to tell definitively whether or not those were related. And this is an especially pressing problem for lung cancer, given that with lung cancer screening, approximately 15 to 20% of people will present with multiple nodules, and us not really being in a position to be able to tell whether those nodules might be related or not.
This research is published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. And finally, blueberries. They are superstars among those who say the fruit is good for heart health, better memory, and digestion. And they also say blueberries improve night vision. Well, some scientists checked out this claim and found maybe they can't help you see better at night. They found a blueberry-rich diet did not improve night vision, but it did help people see better after exposed to bright light. Their report is in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Information you want from specialists who know.
On air, online, and on iHeartRadio, you can listen live by going to our flagship station's website at krocam.com and click Listen Live. Time for you now, though, to join our conversation, and you can contact us by telephone at 507-282-1234. Again, 507-282-1234. You can also tweet us at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
It's Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month, and so that's what our conversation is about with Dr. K. Marie Reed-Lombardo and Dr. Gloria Peterson. I have a myth or matter of fact for you, Dr. Reed-Lombardo. Half of patients undergo surgery for their pancreatic cancer. Myth or fact?
That is a myth. 15 to 20% of patients are candidates for surgery at the time of diagnosis, or some few select patients may be candidates after chemotherapy.
That's such a... to me, a surprisingly small amount. I would think that that'd be the first thing that people have done.
Well, that really highlights the fact that the pancreas cancer is often presenting with an advanced presentation and the disease is no longer localized to the pancreas, but have either spread locally or spread to the liver or other areas in the body.
Okay. Let's talk about the different types of pancreatic cancer. How many of them are there?
Well, there are a number, but two most common, and the two most common are what we call pancreatic adenocarcinoma, which is what most people think of when we say pancreas cancer, and the other is pancreatic, it's an exocrine tumor, and maybe endocrine tumor that Dr. Peterson can comment on.
This is the cancer that Steve Jobs had. It occurs in the islet cells, which is the insulin-producing part of the pancreas. You have to think of the pancreas organ as a twofer. It produces, as we said earlier, the hormone insulin that regulates your blood sugar, and it also produces the enzymes that digest the fats that get secreted into the small intestine. So there are tumors that occur in both places, and the neuroendocrine or the islet cell tumor is the other type. It constitutes around 5% or less of all pancreatic cancer. So
is
the majority are in the ducts of pancreas.
Is there one that's better to have than the other?
Yes.
I want to spin that instead of say one worse. Is there one that's better to have than the other?
Definitely. Having an endocrine tumor, a neuroendocrine tumor, is so much better because the survival is a lot higher, almost close to normal.
I had an opportunity to talk to a Mayo Clinic patient who resides in the Kansas City area, and he faced that exact type of pancreatic cancer and is doing marvelously well. But it sounds like in working in concert with a number of Mayo physicians, they helped choose the most beneficial course of action. And it seems like some of those choices to be made, whether you have chemo first or surgery first and what medications or therapies you choose can make a difference. Why is that?
Really, it's offering an individualized approach. So if a patient has advanced disease, they will be offered chemotherapy. If a patient have what we call locally advanced disease, where surgery may be an option in the future, if we can get things shrunk down with chemo, they may be offered chemo and or radiation therapy. And if a patient has an easily resectable tumor, meaning we can remove it with surgery, they may be offered surgery right away.
Our phone number is 507-282-1234 if you have a question, or you can tweet us at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. A tweeted question, back and abdominal pain are so common. How do you know when to be worried? You had earlier said that that's one of the first symptoms that patients present with. How do you know when it's just a back or abs pain?
A lot of us have fleeting pain. Patients describe this as being deep within the core of their body, It's a deep ache, and it's not easily dismissed. It's constant, and it may be the constellation of symptoms. So weight loss in addition to that, having nausea, having problems digesting your foods, and having maybe a light-colored stool because that bile duct is blocked, or greasy stools that float in the toilet. Mm-hmm. So having a combination of those is what you need to pay attention to.
So it's not an abdominal pain that lasts for the weekend or for
exactly.
a few days. It's something that is ongoing.
Exactly.
Very good. 507-282-1234. Helen has a question about diabetes. Good morning, Helen. Go right ahead with your question.
Yes, I was wondering if someone has type 2 diabetes, they're at increased risk for pancreatic cancer. Does controlling their diabetes reduce their risk?
Dr. Peterson?
I would have to say that the answer is probably not. What most diabetics, when they are diagnosed, they are managed, and they're managed quite well. So they live for a long time, so that's not a problem. It's just probably the dysfunction that's going on in the pancreas that we still don't know. It's still a mystery of how that actually can cause the pancreatic cancer to develop. It still remains a big mystery to us.
Thanks for calling in, Helen. We appreciate your phone call. And you can give us a call, 507-282-1234.
I see an interesting one on your screen here that got tweeted in.
Yeah.
And it seems like a logical question, but the organ that we're talking about, the pancreas, makes it not quite so simple. Dr. Reed Lombardo, is there a preventative surgery for people with a strong genetic predisposition to pancreatic cancer?
That is an excellent question, and I'm sure Dr. Peterson has a comment as well. Speaking from a surgeon's perspective, we're hesitant to do so because we would have to remove the entire pancreas, which really poses a lot of post-operative risk and long-term risk. Patients without their pancreas can become very brittle diabetics and have poor control of their glucose and may have low glucose unawareness and get into trouble from that. Also, cardiac disease development may be enhanced quickly, and so we're talking about young patients and exposing them to that long term. And so there's really no recommendation right now to do so, but in selected cases, we go through a very lengthy and multidisciplinary discussion about whether or not a patient should have their pancreas cancer out. And Dr. Peterson really deals with a lot of these families, so we can ask her what she usually counsels these families.
I would really defer to the clinician's judgment on this matter. There are significant health issues involved once a pancreas is removed, and it's really a normal pancreas, and that's really what is a difficult issue for physicians and scientists like me to grasp. But the other big dimension here is when you have seen loved ones die of it and have gone through significant issues if you have a family history, mm-hmm. and then if you're told, well, you actually carry a gene mutation that might put you at risk, that peace of mind is a huge overriding issue. So we can't dismiss the whole psychological and social issues that a patient is facing, and the incredible worry, and then the sense of, well, I just need to be free of this worry.
Very good. It is Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month, and that's what we want to do, is raise awareness about it. But then that makes people think, man, I've heard so many people that have pancreatic cancer. Myth or matter of fact, Dr. Peterson, is there an epidemic of pancreatic cancer?
It looks like there is one to many people because a lot of their loved ones, particularly grandparents and parents, are suddenly developing it. And one of the demographic issues that's going on in America is that we have something called the baby boom.
Sure.
And pancreatic cancer is one of the biggest risk factors for pancreatic cancer is age. The median age of diagnosis of pancreatic cancer is in the late 60s and early 70s, somewhere around 69 to 71. And so that's the typical age at which a patient is diagnosed. So you can imagine the baby boomers are just now entering this
sure.
window of risk. And so there are a lot more of them. I mean, there are hundreds of millions of baby boomers who are now suddenly at risk just simply because they're older.
That's the age. Mm-hmm. Our phone lines are full, so we have to answer some questions. 507-282-1234. Dave is on the line. He has a question about pancreatic cysts. Good morning, Dave.
What is the outlook for testing of the pancreas, where pancreas cysts have been found in the pancreas, and also, I guess, for want of a better term, I'll call it shrinkage of the pancreas?
Okay, Dr. Reed Lombardo?
I'll answer the last part of the question first. Shrinkage, or what we say atrophy, occurs with age. So just normally over time, the pancreas will get smaller in its size and mass. The first question about cysts is an excellent question. We know, just like the colon has polyps that can develop into pancreas cancer, so does the pancreas.
Hmm.
We have certain cysts in the pancreas. One is IPMN. That is a precursor to pancreas cancer. And sometimes at the time of diagnosis, there may be risks associated with that cyst that we can see on imaging that raises our suspicion for that cyst harboring pancreas cancer. And so we may recommend surgery to remove the cyst. If they're usually small and benign appearing and don't have any worrisome changes, we may recommend surveillance.
Very good. Thanks for calling in, Dave. Does that answer your question?
I think the report says IPMN cysts. Should they be followed?
It depends on the size. If it's a very small cyst, then they may be followed. But I would recommend that you speak to your provider about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling in. Let's go over to Leroy, who has a question about pancreatic transplant. Is that what you want to ask about, Leroy?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if the pancreas is one of those transferable organs, and if somebody is predisposed for it, can you go in and take that out and put in one that from somebody that is not predisposed?
I like it. You can trick your body with a transplant, Dr. Reed Lombardo.
I'm smiling. That's a really good question. Right. Yes, you can transplant the pancreas, and usually it's in patients with very poor diabetic control and renal failure. They can do it in combination with a pancreas and a kidney, or pancreas by itself. Right now, we do not offer transplantation in a prophylactic manner. And so because you're at risk, there's a paucity of pancreases available, as you would probably imagine. And so that would lie really low on the list of patients.
Is that possibly some of the future of treating pancreatic cancer?
Not at this point.
Okay, very good. Leroy, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
All right, let's go over to Fred. Good morning, Fred. Go right ahead with your question.
Yes, I have exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, digestive enzymes insufficiency. Am I now at increased risk of getting pancreatic cancer?
Let's first talk about his diagnosis, Dr. Reed Lombardo.
So it seems as if you may have a diagnosis of pancreatitis or chronic pancreatitis that has left you with poor exocrine function of the pancreas. And so is that a true statement?
Yes, I have to take pills to supplement the digestive enzymes that normally the pancreas would have produced.
So having long-standing or chronic pancreatitis is a risk factor for pancreas cancer. But this is something that your physician who follows you would likely follow up in if there's a change or additional or frequent symptoms occurring.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks so much for calling. Man, we've got great questions today. 507-282-1234. Matt is on the line with a question, too. Good morning, Matt.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering if it was going to be in people's favor with an early predisposition to get a CT scan, or a better way of diagnosing earlier, I guess, or more often.
Some screening options. Thanks for calling, Matt. What do you think, Dr. Peterson?
Yes. There actually are studies that are going on right now by gastroenterologists across the country in clinical trials to try to understand whether or not the pancreas can be screened in people who are at increased risk. The jury is still a little bit out, although I have to say that it is available, actually, even at Mayo Clinic. You could, if you have a strong family history, you can be screened CT, but preferably endoscopic ultrasound, where you have an endoscopy and they put a microphone up against your stomach and image your pancreas, is one of the preferred ways to try to look for any kind of mass. One of the problems that these clinical trials are encountering is that they're finding things that look odd, and they don't know what to make of them. And so they cannot tell the patient yes or no you have a tumor.
Dr. Reed Lombardo, it sounds like patients are often brought in almost as part of the care management team and help make these tough decisions. We have a tweeted question here from someone who has locally advanced pancreatic cancer, and they're wondering how should they make that decision of whether chemo and or radiation is the wisest step to take pre-surgically?
I always tell patients that if that is offered, you can always start. And if you can't tolerate it, you can stop. You always have control in what's happening with you. And so if there's an opportunity available, I recommend taking that opportunity.
Dr. Gloria Peterson, or rather Gloria Peterson from the epidemiological side of it, is there any research that shows one approach favors the patient's outcome?
No. So I would say that we just have to do more research and look at these more patients and over a longer period of time to really understand any kind of pattern.
We have about 60 seconds left.
And I'll follow up with that. Increasingly, more centers in the U.S. are offering chemotherapy and radiation therapy before surgery, even if patients may be eligible directly for surgery. And so these are under trial, and we're examining this, and hopefully we can have more answers in the future.
Let's talk in these last few seconds about the personalized therapy, what the future holds for people who are newly diagnosed with cancer of the pancreas. Dr. Peterson?
Yes, by personalized therapy, and certainly this activity is very active and ongoing at Mayo Clinic, what that involves is if a tumor is analyzed for example, genomic changes, there are chemotherapeutic agents that could be targeted specifically to that alteration that has occurred in the tumor. That's basically personalized therapy in a nutshell. At Mayo Clinic, we actually have a funded project. A clinical trial is actually open in which a patient can have their tumor evaluated for a whole host of factors known as DNA repair gene changes, and then the trial that would actually inhibit that DNA repair defect could be offered to the patient as a second-line therapy.
All right, and we're done. We're out of time, but Dr. Reed Lombardo, would you please tell us again the symptoms for pancreas cancer and what people should be aware of?
Great. Back pain, weight loss, nausea, vomiting, yellowing of the skin, changes in your stool so that the stool may become light colored because the bile isn't coloring and browning the stool, maybe floating in the toilet. All those are possible symptoms.
One of the things I even saw on the list was depression.
Depression can be associated with a lot of cancers.
Interesting.
So that might be.
A wealth of information this morning from
Absolutely.
Our experts.
Absolutely. I need to take a break. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having
us. Dr. Kamari
Thank you.
Lombardo and Dr. Gloria Peterson. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we're going to tell you about next week's program. It's one of my favorite ones from the whole year. We're going to be hearing that again next week. Stay with us. Welcome back. Next week, we're going to be rebroadcasting, and it's true, one of my favorite shows of the whole year is about groundbreaking research, which involves the measles virus in a fight against cancer. Dr. Stephen Russell will be here, well, he was here, with his patient, Stacy Erholtz. He gave her 10 million doses of the measles virus to treat her multiple myeloma.
A single shot, and 6 months later, I sat there with her while she went through the PET scan, and there was no active cancer to be seen in her body at all.
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. And Stacy came to the studio. She was here. She called a fake girls weekend with one of her best friends and said, well, I got to go to Rochester because she lives in northern Minnesota. And they were here, and we talked about that. It was wonderful. I'm really excited to rebroadcast it. So I hope that you'll listen, and I hope that you will be part of that program. For more information on topics discussed on this program, please visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program, as well as previously aired Mayo Clinic radio episodes. And that's not all. At mayoclinic.org, there are over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers to help you manage your health, including your chance to buy that Going Gluten-Free book.
If you go to mayoclinic.org, in fact, and you're inspired, you know, to research some of the clinical trials that the doctor spoke about this morning, just click clinical trials in the search bar there, and you'll find some very interesting stuff.
On Mayo Clinic Radio, our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, your associate producer and phone screener is Audrey Castletine. Our technical director is Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio and Dr. Reed Lombardo and Dr. Peterson, I'm Tracy McRae.
And I'm Dennis Dotto. We thank you so much for listening.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.